I don't know how quiet and simple I was on that. I think I was delighted, actually. But I am honored. I'm speaking on what I call the British paradigm in the thought of Jimmy Bradford. In the historical and political essays of Mel Bradford, there are developed a number of social paradigms or models of what a healthy society should be and how it should function, as well as negative paradigms, models of how societies should not function. Mr. Dennis, I think, in his remarks on New England and Mel Bradford's thought, will give us an example of one of these negative paradigms. As for the positive paradigms, obviously the most important one is the American South itself, and clearly much of Bradford's thought revolves around the Southern historical and literary traditions. But if Bradford were only a Southern thinker who had thought only about the South, his importance would be much more parochial, and his legacy as one of the most significant conservative thinkers of the late 20th century would be far less than it is. One reason for Bradford's continuing importance to non-Southern and even non-American conservatives follows directly from his construction and use of social and historical paradigms other than the Southern one from which he himself emerged and to which his principal loyalties and interests belonged. One other paradigm in his thought is that of the Roman Republic, as evidenced in his well-known article on the importance of the Roman Republic for the framers of the American Republic, and also in a companion essay on Romanitas in Southern literature, and indeed at various places in a number of other essays and studies written at one time or another throughout his career. A study of the importance of classical themes in Bradford's work would be rewarding in itself, but there is yet a third paradigm that repeatedly recurs in his work, and that is the model of Old England, what I call the British paradigm. The British paradigm in Bradford's thought has at least two functions. In the first place, Britain is seen as ancestral to, and therefore continuous with, and formative of, the American political and cultural order. And thereby, the British paradigm assists in the conservative legitimation of American society as the product of long-continuing tradition and challenges the liberal and libertarian Lockean view of America as a contractually created and rationally designed order. In the second place, Britain and British political society serve Bradford as models in their basic mechanisms and characteristic ways of operating of how any healthy social order should function, regardless of historical continuity with America. Unlike the abstract and utopian paradigms of societies that never existed except in the mind's eye, the secular visionary paradigms of the sort that Bradford never failed to scorn and ridicule, the British paradigm was one that emerged from history and was wedded to another historical paradigm to which it was ancestral and therefore legitimizing. Both the ancestral as well as the other, what might be called the normative function of the British paradigm, is fully evident in one of Bradford's later essays, The Best Constitution in Existence, The Influence of the British Example on the Framers of Our Fundamental Law, published in his posthumous Original Intentions. Bradford's stated purpose in dwelling on the influence of the British example is to counter the current fashion, as he writes, of reading history backward, by which fashion this generation persists in construing the United States Constitution in a vacuum, forgetting how most of our American forebears cherished the English Constitution and did not change their opinion of its merits just because Parliament and the ministers of King George III failed to observe some of its provisions. When we see the framers in proper historical context, Bradford writes, it becomes clear that their handiwork, like its prototype, was the result not merely of philosophy, but of an historical outgrowth. And it is difficult to overemphasize the English constitutional inheritance of the American people. He is also entirely specific as to just what that legal and constitutional inheritance consisted in. Thus, from the English Bill of Rights, we derive our guarantees of regular sessions of Congress, our rules prescribing that money bills originate in the House of Representatives, our protections for the privileges of Congress to regulate itself, many limitations on the president's power, and the elaborate provisions for the impeachment of government officers of every description, including federal judges. The language in our Constitution protecting the writ of habeas corpus comes from the English Act of 1679, treating of that subject, and before that from the Magna Carta. The English Bill of Rights is also reflected in the 1st, 2nd, 5th, 6th, and 8th Amendments to the United States Constitution. The 1st and 3rd Amendments also derive from the Glorious Petition of Right of 1628. The definition of treason is, of course, from Edward III's 1352 Statute of Treason and a protection of the subject against political prosecutions. I might add that no one but Mel would have modified the derivation of the constitutional definition of treason from a Parliamentary Act 1352 by the phrase, of course. The influence of the British example on the U.S. Constitution shows clearly what I have called the ancestral function of the British paradigm. In Bradford's thought, the legitimacy of the U.S. Constitution in no small degree derives precisely from its historic continuity with its British predecessor, and not in any way from the nature of a social contract or natural rights divorced from history. Moreover, not only the legitimacy of the Constitution, but also the very human comprehension of the meaning of the Constitution is also inseparable from the historical context. And what is a clear expression of what a Straussian would immediately damn as the most rank historicism, Bradford writes, to approach the text of the framers' constitution without knowing the history of the Norman conquest, the Wars of the Roses, the attainder of the Earl of Strafford, or the Glorious Revolution, to read it without some introduction to the English Civil War of the 1640s and the 18th century debate about the nature of rightful authority over free Englishmen is to misconceive the purpose embodied in the new American constitution as it stood in 1791. Bradford's exposition of the debt of the framers to their British forebears is not a mere exercise in Whiggish commonplaces. He is fully aware that to many of the framers, the British example meant different things. Some looking to the interpretations offered by Blackstone, by Hume, by Bolingbroke, the medieval legacy of the mixed regime, or the conflict between court and country in 18th century British politics. Despite this variety of interpretive strategies employed by the framers, he writes, they understood the ancestral constitution and used it in different ways to their political assumptions. Indeed, even those of the framers' generation who disliked the U.S. Constitution nevertheless cited the British paradigm as their model, arguing, as did Patrick Henry in the Virginia ratification debate, that there is not an English feature in it, that is, in the proposed constitution. But basing his objections to the Philadelphia document on the argument that it deviated too much from the British Constitution. That country, said Henry of Britain, is become a great, mighty, and splendid nation, not because their government is strong and energetic, sir, but because liberty is its direct end and foundation. Nor did the response to Henry's argument challenge the British paradigm contained in his premise. Both George Nicholas and James Monroe also argued for ratification in terms of what they took the British legacy to be. But if the British paradigm was ancestral to the American Constitution, it was also normative in a non-ancestral sense, reflecting what British conservative thinker Michael Oakeshott called a nomocratic order, which several of the speakers today have already referred. One, as Bradford characterized it, better defined by an established way of conducting business than by a set of goals. The goal-oriented, or in Oakeshott's companion term, teleocratic order, being represented by such non-British and non-American regimes as those of the French Revolution, the Soviet state, and the other ideological experiments of modernity. If the British paradigm is both ancestral and therefore legitimizing of the American constitutional order, as well as a normative model of nomocratic order, it makes sense that the representative men produced by the British paradigm should also parallel the representative leaders of American society. While Bradford did not write at any great length on the chief personae of British history, there are two individuals who figure in his writings who serve as, in the one case, a positive, and in the other, a negative paradigm. The first is the Duke of Wellington, the second, Oliver Cromwell. Thus, in a review essay of two biographies of Wellington by Sir Arthur Bryant and Elizabeth Longford, Bradford presents the Iron Duke as a normative exemplar of political leadership in the British paradigm. Bryant, he writes, makes explicit the way in which the great Duke's military adventures in Holland, India, Portugal, Spain, and France were finally an extension of his political philosophy. How Arthur Wellesley, that is the Duke, was listening to the archaic ancestral voices when he understood himself to be retained for life by crown and constitution, and therefore was preparing throughout his pre-Waterloo years to form an army that was an incarnation of the English temper. Wellington, on Bradford's view, had his great forerunners and earlier leaders of the British nation, and these, quoting Bryant, personified the spirit of proud subordination which makes an army or a nation in the old sense, as Bradford in a parenthetical note, and which has nothing to do with servility. And each affirmed the very English equality of manhood which comes with honorable service in the line, the rule that he who is with the king on St. Crispin's Day shall be by him called brother. Moreover, while Bryant, as a Tory, could write with immediate sympathy and support for Wellington, for Lady Longford, a British laborite, the task was more difficult. But, writes Bradford, she is English before she is socialist. And her theme throughout her biography is the Duke's idea of the almost mystical union between himself and the state meaning here not the apparatus of government, but the patria, the British paradigm itself. Wellington, writes Bradford, gloried not in his control of the state, nor in the intellectual grasp of its nature in becoming, but rather in service to its immediate needs. His will was to defend a given, and such a will has indeed an almost counter-revolutionary ideological force, but informed by genuine love for what is given, especially a constitution, with a monarch as its steward and visible embodiment. And if Wellington, though coming very late to be grouped with the exemplars of an older England, is nevertheless an exemplar of the British paradigm in the flesh, having his parallels with Washington, Lee, and the politico-military leaders of the American South, he also has his antithesis in Cromwell, whose Gnostic arrogation to himself of the role of both national savior and messianic nationalist was itself a kind of satanic paradigm for his ideological descendants, most especially for Americans, the divine Abraham. As an American, writes Bradford in his essay on Cromwell, long ago exposed to political Puritans, I cannot help thinking of Cromwell by way of analogy to other men on an errand. To our version of the species, and especially to the late Gnostics, who, in God's name, forged a union of fire and iron in our great civil war. In Lincoln, all of their lineaments are visible, in a manner even more secular, it must be admitted, but making the same sound, hiding practical purposes in the same rhetoric of derivative authority, and also in Lincoln's chief captains, Grant and Sherman. In Stark Young's fine novel, So Red the Rose, the latter, Sherman, calls upon the parents of a former student and offers human courtesy. Shortly thereafter, in their official capacity, Sherman's troopers burn the family out. These Southerners are puzzled at such schizophrenia. They should have studied a life of Cromwell and then emptied the house. And if the British paradigm is seen as ancestral to the American constitutional and national identity and as providing representative exemplars in Wellington and other statesmen parallel to American counterparts, the same paradigm is also seen as ancestral to the South itself, the principal paradigm in Bradford's work. Thus, in an early essay, First Fathers, the Colonial Origins of the Southern Tradition, Bradford writes of the formation of the Virginia planter class that the free planter learned to trust himself to be, by his location in Virginia or Carolina, something more than an Englishman, though only incidentally and unself-consciously so, out of his whole Englishness. Like the Constitution back home, he became organically. He discovered himself in practice. This locational pull toward independence and innovation, however, was balanced by the countervailing force of the British paradigm. Yet, writes Bradford, from the other side came the tug of the overall social model, acceptance of the English church, law, political habits, and international concerns, and a freedom from all prospect of felt discontinuity. And the centrality of land and agricultural economy in the South were the foundation of the Southern landed classes, which themselves were the basis of the Southern patriarchy, which Bradford describes as a social system more like old Scotland or the Britain of the Anglo-Saxons than the England of Dr. Johnson. The British model was present in the Southern colonies, Bradford argues, from their founding, citing Michael Drayton's poem of 1606 to the Virginia voyage, to show that unlike New England, whose founders conceived of it as a new society, Drayton projected the Virginia colony as merely an extension of old Britain. Drayton envisages no attempt to improve upon the dominant culture of Britannia. In that conception of the South as an extension of old Britain, Bradford also calls up the image of Aeneas, the Trojan whose voyage to Italy led to the founding of Rome as an extension of Troy, and thereby he unites the paradigms of Britain, Rome, and the South, and distinguishes them at the end of his essay from the negative paradigm of New England. It might be rewarding if there were time to dwell for a while on what it was exactly in the British paradigm, in British social, political, and cultural arrangements that Bradford found so compelling and so normative. But very briefly, I believe those qualities can be summarized in Oakeshott's concept of the nomocratic order, a concept that, as far as I know, Bradford described explicitly in only one passage, discussing Patrick Henry's argumentation against ratification of the Constitution. Henry's arguments, writes Bradford, were all directed toward liberty and away from an extreme telos, all finally productive of what we now know as the Bill of Rights. His America did not exist to pursue certain military, economic, moral, or philosophic objectives. To borrow language from a group of his most articulate political descendants, he scorned the notion of a culture poured in from the top, whatever the rationale. Rather, his social political vision was what Michael Oakeshott has called nomocratic and Eric Voegelin compact. Most of Bradford's references to Oakeshott are to the antithetical concept of a teleocratic regime that is poured in from the top, that is, rationally designed and artificially and usually coercively imposed upon the historic social order. And it was the essential characteristic of the British paradigm that it grew, evolved, or developed from the bottom up, as it were, or muddled through, or came into existence in an absence of mind. All these terms and the very concept of British society existing as a long continuing tradition are, of course, part of the old Whig understanding of British history and politics, represented in the 18th century by Edmund Burke, and in the 20th, in many respects at any rate, by Oakeshott himself, and by F.A. Hayek, who, like Bradford, also used the term old Whig to describe himself, and whose social thought was in many respects an elaboration of the remark of Adam Ferguson that human society is a product of human action, but not of human design. That is, not poured in from the top, the spontaneous order, as it's called. I'm not at all certain that Bradford would concur with Hayek's claim that human society is naturally a spontaneous order. I think rather he would have argued that some societies have been fortunate enough to have grown from the bottom up and to have avoided or resisted efforts to reorder them by pouring in a new, rationally designed identity by force. It is precisely the circumstantial rather than the natural character of such societies that makes them valuable and precious as paradigms. And that is why such grown societies as those of old Britain, the American Old Republic, and the Old South offer paradigmatic lessons through their historical experience that are better guides to what human civilization can and should be than the rationalist constructions of the teleocratic regimes. Thank you.